Welcome to the Hilltop United Methodist Church podcast. Hilltop is located in Sandy, Utah, 985 East, 10,600 South. Locals would say 106th. Our two worship services are at 9 o'clock and 10:30. Hope to see you this Sunday. God bless. Bye-bye. Good morning, saints.
Good morning.
Good morning, sinners.
Good morning.
There you go. Week one, we talked about why God. And some of the things we talked about in that why God conversation flowed over into the idea of why the church. Now, those two sermons were 65 minutes, 35 and 30. And so I won't give you the whole 65 minutes all over again. Let's see if I can do it in 65 seconds, all right? Which was, essentially, we, across cultures, across time, have this hole in our soul that we believe needs to be fed. It needs to be fed. And God seems to be the active agent that fills that hole. It isn't necessarily an Abrahamic God, but it's this idea there's a power greater than us. Flowing from that idea of the fact that there is a power greater than us, it gives us some divine instructions, some powerful words of how it is that we conduct our lives. Moving from general guidance over to the idea of an Abrahamic God, God that's found in Genesis 11, Genesis 12, and moves on. We then have this idea of how God lays out for us this plumb line. This plumb line and how it is that we construct our lives, how it is we so order our lives so we can follow God in it. And we understand where it is that we're out of relationship with God and the rest of God's creation, not just God, but God's creation as well. In the Old Testament, it's a plumb line, is one of the ideas they have there. In the New Testament, they use it archery terminology, which is our goal is to try and hit the mark. And when we miss the mark, that's sin. And it's an opportunity for us to stop and evaluate how it is that we're missing the mark in our relationship with God and our relationship with the world that is around us. C.S. Lewis makes the point that we find joy in by being in proper relationship with God. Is that 65 seconds? Did I do okay? I advertised this as we're going to talk about the United Methodist Church, but the reality is I think we're going to talk first quite a bit about the Wesleyan movement. The movement that originates with John Wesley, an 18th century Anglican priest. Anglican is the name that's given to the Church of England. The Church of England. John Wesley lived his entire adult life as an Anglican priest. Had some experiences in Georgia. He was frankly a bit of a failure as a pastor in Savannah, Georgia in 1735. And went home in some measure of shame. But he began a movement that when the original people were calling it Methodist, they were using it as a criticism. It was not an endorsement. John and Charles Wesley were part of a group in Oxford, England in 1730 or so that was called the Holiness Club, the Holy Club. And the people that would want to make fun of that club would talk about, well, you don't want to go be part of that Wesley group because they're just a bunch of Methodists. And what they meant by that was is that Wesley, the two Wesleys and their friends, had figured out a way to try to orderly, in a very orderly, precise fashion, figure out a way of how it is that you could be in proper relationship with God and the world around you. And what began as a term of criticism, a term of derision, a term of snottiness, we're better than them because they're just Methodists. The Wesley brothers took this and endorsed it. They picked it up and said, that's pretty cool because that actually does sort of describe who we are. So what started off as a criticism became a badge of honor with them. And they took that and endorsed it. Now, it's important for us, and I made the comment earlier, that Wesley started off as an Anglican, lived his life as an Anglican, and he died as an Anglican. His purpose of getting this movement going within the Anglican Church was about church renewal. It was about church renewal. It was not to create a new denomination. That wasn't his overall strategy. The church in 1740 England had lost its way. It had lost its way. It had not properly modernized. It had not dealt with the fact that large, enormous groups of people had moved from the countryside into London, into Birmingham, into Manchester, and into those kinds of places. So the Industrial Revolution was going on, and the Anglican Church still only, and maybe hypothetically Manchester, would only have 8 or 10 priests. Why? Because 100 years ago they only had 8 or 10 priests. What's the problem? And what Wesley did was he began a movement of taking people like you, lay people, relatively untrained people, and he taught them how to be leaders within the Anglican Church, trying to get people back into the Anglican Church on Sunday morning, while at the same time trying to modernize the Anglican Church to start creating more churches where the people actually were. Susan Dunlap is going to talk to us in a couple of weeks about new church starts, and I would say to you, we still have trouble sometimes getting this lesson through our skull, which is we need to keep reminding ourselves that part of the task of the church is to be the church where people actually are. So she's going to talk a little bit about that idea. Now, Wesley, just as Thomas Jefferson, a couple of weeks ago when I talked about the Declaration of Independence, and I used the idea of the fact that there was this dichotomy, this paradox, this hypocrisy, if you will, in the nature of how Thomas Jefferson could write, "We believe that all people are created with certain unalienable rights." At the same time, the people writing those words own slaves. I mean, we sit here in 2015, look back at this, and go, how did they think that? Well, what on earth were they thinking? All right? And all I can suggest to you is it was a different world. It was a different world, and they had certain different sets of values. Because Wesley, for example, could sit here and say, we need to be able to get along with everybody. We need to be able to get along with everybody we possibly can. And then almost the very next paragraph of his writing, or the very next rhetorical device in a sermon, he could then launch into a pretty stiff criticism of Catholics and people that we would also now call Presbyterians. In those days, they might have been called Calvinists. They were followers of John Calvin, the Swiss theologian of the 16th century. And so part of what I'm going to get into the theology comment here is that we're going to talk a little bit about that. But the point really is that in their world, there were certain givens. And so I can sit here and go, you know, everybody, let's all try to get along well together. But those Calvinists, they just don't understand how it is to find God. In their world, they didn't see any paradox in that. They didn't see any attention in that. In our world, we see that, we hear it, we read it, we sit there and go, wow, that's a head-scratcher. What the heck is going on? Now, Wesley did not intend to start a denomination. He ended up starting multiple denominations, okay? And we talk about the Wesleyan movement, including the United Methodist Church, but it's more than the United Methodist Church. It's the Church of the Nazarene is a Wesleyan tradition. The Salvation Army is a Wesleyan tradition. Did you guys know that? The Salvation Army is a church. Did you guys know that? Yep. Church, okay? Not fair. You have a master's degree in theology.
I knew it before that.
Okay, all right.
My former pastor.
2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we talked about a church in South Carolina. Charleston, thank you. Thank you very much. It was an AME, and I didn't tell you what AME stood for. It stood for African Methodist Episcopal. It's an offshoot of the Wesleyan movement, dated about 1790 or so. And frankly, it's a shame on the Methodist Church that it had to happen, because it was essentially in order to have their own church, a group of people had to break off and create their own church that where blacks could feel welcome. AME Zion is the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Zion. There's Free Methodist out there. There's a movement in the South that was originally called the Colored Methodist Episcopal. We now call it the Christian Methodist Episcopal. And I'm probably not exhaustive there. There is, I mean, I've just given you the highlights. There's more to it than that. So Wesley was one of the giants of that. And mostly what I'm going to talk about today is indeed John Wesley and the Wesleyan theology that's behind that. That having been said, there was a second giant that Wesley deployed from England to North America about 1770 or so. And American Methodism has got his thumbprints all over it. If you were to go into a tavern in 1804 in Virginia, and the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, would be standing there with Francis Asbury, the premier bishop of Methodism in the early part of the 19th century, in this pre-photograph, pre-internet world, if you were to ask the average person in that tavern and say, those two people over there, who are they? The average person would say, I don't know who the tall redheaded guy is, but the guy next to him is Francis Asbury. That's how pervasive the influence was of Asbury. Wesley traveled about 10,000 miles a year on horseback. Can't imagine doing that day in and year out. And Asbury did the same kind of thing. Methodism exists in the United States because of the diligent work of Wesley setting it up in England and then Asbury carrying it out in North America. When Asbury was made a bishop about 1783 or so, there were only about 20,000 Methodists in all of North America. By the time we got to the Civil War, about 1860 or so, it was the dominant form of Protestantism in the United States. The dominant form. Frankly, because of the indefatigable work of these two men in setting up things and how they carried it out. Enough history. What makes Methodism different? I'm always reluctant to go here because I'm not a student of the United Church of Christ. I'm not a student of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm not a student of Presbyterianism. You get the idea. Every time I tease Roberta something to do about Lutheranism, she always corrects me and lets me know that I'm wrong. But I want to start there with, if those of you that are paying attention this week, Harper Lee has a new book out. Harper Lee was the author of To Kill a Mockingbird. And she had this book that was a sequel but written earlier than To Kill a Mockingbird. She was a little younger when she wrote it. And in that book, she describes a Southern preacher who's a Methodist. And she writes, Jimson was a Methodist of the whole cloth. He was notoriously short on theology and a mile long on good works. Notoriously short on theology and a mile long on good works. Now, I would say contrasting Methodism to Catholicism, for example, I would buy into the idea that we're short on theology. If you were to contrast us with even any of the Orthodox stuff, Russian, Greek, Serbian, all those Orthodox, I would say we're probably short on theology. I'm not sure about the other denominations, but I think and Harper Lee was a Methodist before she went. She was a Methodist at one time anyway. I can see why she would write those kind of words, which is short on theology, long on good works, because if you're a person who's focused on deepness of theology, and that's where you're focused, you could say that Methodists were short on their theology. Let's talk, though, for a second about what makes Methodists Methodists. And I would say to you that the first thing that we have that we believe that makes Methodist Methodist is our attitude towards grace, God's unmerited mercy, God's loving kindness poured out on us even before we thought we deserved it. And the only reason I included that Genesis passage there was not to get into this whole conversation of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot and all of that kind of thing, except that it was the very first usage of the word chesed, God's loving kindness, that is used in the Old Testament. It's a concept. God's grace is in the Old Testament. And if you think about the nature of the narrative of God's relationship with the children of Israel, how God picks Abraham out, over and over and over again, we clearly get the idea that Abraham and his followers, that Israel as a community, have done nothing to warrant the special attention they've gotten from God. God's grace is part of the nature of the relationship that exists between God and this founding developmental group, what we endorse as part of our holy book. The New Testament, we have this idea of grace, and frankly, again, it's this idea of unmerited mercy. We focused it in the form of Jesus Christ, Jesus walking among us, God coming to be with us, incarnate, in the flesh, and then sacrificing himself on our behalf. God's grace made visible through Jesus Christ. And again, the critical element of that is we've done nothing to earn it. You don't earn God's grace. It's given to you free. Now, Wesley would argue that there were three component parts to grace. Three component parts to it. One is the nature of how grace goes before you even know it exists. The way you break the word down, it's a long 35-cent word. It's more than a 25-cent word. You've got to have an extra dime to pronounce it. And it's called prevenient grace. And it's the pre-event grace. What's the event? It's the event of you saying to God, God, I'm yours. Do with me as you will. That's that willingness to bend the arc of your life to God's arc on your behalf. But there are some out there that think God's grace is only extended once you make that statement. And Wesley says, No, I really do disagree with that concept. I disagree with that idea fundamentally, because God's grace is still there even for those who don't even know that God exists, who don't even know that God is nurturing them and caring for them all along the way. I am evidence to you of God's prevenient grace nurturing me before I even knew that God was out there. For my grandmother, Marilyn's care for me, the fact that I had bosses the way I did who nurtured and cared for me when I was probably in a state of somewhat some disbelief. But God's grace was still there. And my guess is each one of you has some kind of similar story out there of where God's grace comes to you before you know that God is in your life. Now, but that having been said, Wesley had this idea that there was two more levels to that, which was justifying and sanctifying. Justifying is a legal term. You've been found not guilty. You're no longer guilty of all the stuff you've ever done in your whole life. And it happens in whatever the shortest measurement of time you can conceptualize it to be, whether it's a nanosecond or a billionth of a second or a billionth of a second or whatever it is. But whenever it is that you sit down and say, God, I'm yours. Here I am. Take me. Let me serve you. And you go from being in a state of sinful nature to being saved. I mean, bang, it's instantaneous on the ground. That's what this is intended to be. It's a grab. So you're down here in a state of unsaved status. God's nurturing you with prevenient grace. And all of a sudden, bang, you have now been made justified. You have been found not guilty of all the stuff that you've ever done in your whole life. All right? And it stays up like that. Now, but conversely, though, you then set about your life as a life of holiness. Holiness is a fancy word that means set apart. That's all it means. And so you're saying that I now want to pursue a life of sanctification. Sanctification and holiness mean the same thing. And I want to be holy. I want to be different than the rest of the world. And so I now set myself on a path of activity that causes me to be holy in God's world. Going back to the Harper Lee. Jemison was Methodist of the whole cloth. He was notoriously sharp, short on theology, and a mile long on good works. I would argue that Wesley might be construed as being short on theology because he focuses in part on the idea that if you are truly a person of faith, if you really are a person who said, God, take me, I'm yours, do with me as you will, and then tonight it became illegal to be a Christian, is there enough evidence for tomorrow then to convict you of the crime of being a Methodist, being a Christian? And Wesley would say, unless there is, I'm not sure you're really carrying through. Wesley was very much a follower of this idea that's found in James. Faith by itself, in and of itself, is insufficient. Faith requires some action, some works on your behalf, that you're doing on behalf of God. I was raised Baptist. I understand the nature of saved by faith. I really do get that theory. Okay? I've been around enough to understand over here that you may be saved by faith, but you have to work your way into heaven. All right? Wesley's sort of in the middle of those two ideas. Yes, you are saved by faith, but there needs to be some tangible evidence of that. So you can see why Harper Lee might sit there and say, a mile long on good works. Because works is important to Wesley, but it's the fruitfulness. It's the fruit that is produced as a result of your faith in God. You trust God in such a way that you can produce fruit on behalf of God in the world. And that fruit may depend upon what your gifts are. There's no clear evidence that it has to be red and this big around. And it's multiple levels of things. But Wesley expects you to be fruitful in what it is you do, driven by your faith. Now, going back to my comment about the schizophrenia that exists there, Wesley was in tension over and over and over again in the 18th century with those that were believed in a very strong form of predestination, a very strong form of the fact that who was going to be saved by God was a very limited subset of people. I don't believe that's where Presbyterianism in the 21st century, okay? But the nature of where it was in the 18th century set in motion some tensions that exist there. And Wesley used those tensions to help explain what was going on, how it was that he understood our relationship with God. And it's against five letters, and they work out to where if you were doing a crossword puzzle, they would spell TULIP, T-U-L-I-P. And the first one is where Wesley would agree with the Calvinist of his day. The Calvinist of his day would say, you only find God in such a way that you do it by depending upon God's action in your life. And Wesley would say, I'm on with that. They call it total depravity. But we're incapable of getting to a relationship with God, the world around us, in and of ourselves, by ourselves. We need God's help to do that. Think 12-step programs. 12-step programs are contingent upon the idea that I can only get to step 12 if I recognize that I am not the center of the universe. And that I need to get to this true place by submitting my will to the will of a divine power. And Wesley would agree with that 100%. Then the next four is where we have some disagreement, which was the fact that there were people in Wesley's day which said that people were chosen by God. Some people were chosen by God and some people were not chosen by God. That made Wesley very uncomfortable. The term is unconditional election. And Wesley believed, as it relates to the next one, which was limited atonement. The limited atonement and the unconditional election go hand in glove. They're actually in handshake. Because those two are essentially saying that God's sacrifice on the cross was for a subset of people, not all people. Right? And Wesley, he just could not wrap his mind around that idea biblically. And so he was an active agent of trying to remind us that God's mercy, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross, is extended to everyone. Not just a few people, but to everyone. Now, the fourth letter is irresistible grace. And that the idea behind that is that once God has chosen you and decided you're the one, that you're part of the elect, you can't get off the hook. You cannot get off the hook. You will bend the arc of your life to God's will. And Wesley says, no. You know, there's this thing out there called free will. We've got this whole thing in Genesis 3. Over and over again, throughout the Bible, I've got these examples of where people that are chosen by God say yes, and then things happen. And things go a little crazy, a little wacko. And they get screwed up. And so consequently, Wesley would say, God's grace is resistible. God chooses, even though this God has unlimited power, God chooses to be weak in our relationship with him. By inviting us, it's an invitation to relationship. It's not God's not a puppet master putting God's hand in the back of us and all of a sudden animating us into motion. All right? Irresistible. If grace is irresistible, Wesley would argue that it is operating that way. And finally, the last point was is that the perseverance of the saints, which is once saved, always saved. Wesley would say, well, yeah, but there are backsliders. There are backsliders. I mean, you can start off on this graph I couldn't do it early this morning either.
Okay, the other side.
You start off here, and you're moving in the right direction, and then something happens where you come in and say, you know, I don't believe in this God stuff anymore. Now, of course, the nature of those who believe in irresistible grace and perseverance of saints who doesn't believe that you would never come in and say that. All right? But Wesley believed you could backslide. You could sacrifice your salvation. You could, by things that you did in your life, you could sacrifice that. And so that set him up in tension with some of the people of his day. At some point in time, not today, I'm going to have to get into the quadrilateral, which is scripture, experience, tradition, reason. The main point I really want to focus on today, just for a few brief seconds, is that Wesley invites you to think. Wesley invites you to think. Wesleyanism as a movement has never subscribed to the theory that you walk into the church door, take your brain, pop the top of your head open, take your brain out, drop it in the momentary brain depository for 1 hour, and then listen to the sermon, listen to all the music, and walk back out and put your brain back in. Okay? Doesn't believe in that. He believes that you should be able to use this for good purposes in order to be able to understand what God calls you to do and how it is that you are called to be a person of God in the world. He doesn't ask you to check your brain in at the door. One of the things that the Wesleyan movement invites is deep personal reflection in who it is that you are and what it is that you're called to do. Reason is an important part of following God. Now, I could go on for days, and I know you're sitting there going, please don't. Please don't. But I would say to you that the beauty of what I like about the Methodist Church is the fact that it deals with this idea of the fact that we do have holes in our soul. And it allows you to have a wide range of how that hole is filled in your soul. It's not particularly dogmatic on many issues, but there is enough dogma there that we still, I think, can have a core belief structure. But I would say to you that any denomination which simultaneously has in it Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, and Hillary Clinton at the same time, is a large tent denomination. And we want to be a large tent denomination. We don't want to drive people out of the tent. We'll make the tent large enough that lots of people can be there. And that's an invitation for all of us that are there. Finally, is the fact that I think one of the core elements of the Wesleyan movement is this idea of the fact that we hold each other accountable. There's an accountability element associated, embedded in to Methodism. I didn't cover because it would have taken too long. But there's an element there for us that if indeed the element is this, we get a plumb line, we have an idea of what sin looks like, we're invited within Methodism to offer critiques, so offer some insight, offer some wisdom to people when they're not going in that direction. Now, some people call that meddling. Wesley would suggest that you're helping people to faithfulness. You're inviting people to faithfulness. Now, the passage for us out of the three women here, was that the voice of angels? Wow. The passage here for us invites us to understand. This is a group of tired Christians. They're a little worn out. And what the preacher is driving at here in this particular section is that let's go boldly and claim that grace. Let's boldly come up into the temple and claim that grace has been set aside for us because it allows us to be able to be different people in this world. Do you believe that taking guilt off of people and allowing them to move guilt-free out into the world in order to serve God, to serve a God that says you need to be active and involved in demonstrating what it looks like to be Jesus in the world, do you think that's a bad religion? I don't. I don't. I find that to be remarkably powerful. And I'm proud. I'm proud to be a Methodist pastor. My own story of coming to faith in April of 1991 was a Nazarene chaplain. And he was up talking about Jesus touching the lepers. I can't think of a greater story to define what it is with Methodism. And the fact that we're willing to leave over and over and over again, the nature of being a Methodist is this, or a Wesleyan follower, is this idea of leaving the sanctuary, leaving the building, and going out in the world and touching the metaphorical lepers of the world and helping them come to a place of wholeness. We start off as a movement. We start off as a renewal movement. We can sometimes lose our way because we get ourselves fixated in buildings and air conditioners and heaters and parking lots and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, Wesleyanism is still a movement. It's still a movement about touching those that are outside the circle. Next week, we're going to sing the idea of make the circle wide. Anytime in the movement we have an idea that wants to make the circle smaller, I think they're rejecting the ideas of John Wesley. And I'm frustrated with the United Methodist Church in particular over the issue of homosexuality. Our current position on homosexuality is that it's incompatible with the Christian lifestyle. No matter where you are on that particular issue, to take a category of people and make them contemporary lepers and say they're not welcome in God's church is incompatible with what it is that Christ did on the cross and how it is that he died for us and what Wesley's life was dedicated to, which was making sure that all people had a chance to experience God's love and God's grace. So I'm a little frustrated with us on that particular one. We'll see how it all evolves. We're not perfect. We're not perfect. We're just human beings doing the best we possibly can. But at the end of the day, I am proud to be a Methodist pastor. I am proud to be the pastor of this particular Methodist church because I think we embody so much of what Wesley advocated and suggested and lived, which if you think about it in his deepest way, Wesley was an 18th century version of Jesus in the world. Let us pray. Gracious and loving God, there's so much we could talk about in the form of understanding what your servant, John Wesley, looked like and did, how it is that Francis Asbury spread that gospel out into your world. But let us understand that your grace is poured out for all of us, and that we can be your people by picking that grace up and then responding to it by helping change the world just a little bit. And all of God's children say, Amen. Please stand as you're able. We're going to sing, By Grace We Have Been Saved. Verse 3 will be women. Verse 4 will be men. Now, the challenge was laid down for you pretty good, men, at 9 o'clock. Those men sounded...
Hilltop is located in Sandy, Utah, 985 East, 10,600 South. Locals would say 106th. Our two worship services are at 9 o'clock and 10:30. Hope to see you this Sunday. God bless. Bye-bye.